Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. What steps should Congress take to deal with more than 60,000 undocumented children who are being detained in the southwestern part of the country after they cross the border into the United States? President Obama has proposed a nearly $4 billion package to deal with this crisis. The money would be used to house these children, put more federal agents on the border, and hire more immigration judges. House Republican leaders are insisting that any budget bill also include some major changes to the 2008 human trafficking law that allows unaccompanied children to have a hearing and legal representation before they can be deported. But Senate Democrats, including Senator Patrick Leahy, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, strongly oppose the House plan.
It's unconscionable to push them through our complicated legal system, terrified, alone, without a lawyer, and with the ultimate idea that they'd be summarily deported back into the very danger they fled. I will vote against anything that allows such a travesty.
How will this immigration crisis be resolved? That's one of the questions we have for our guest today, and that's Congressman Peter Welch. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. A great opportunity to talk with Congressman Peter Welch about any issues on your mind. Once again, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net or give us a call. 1-800-639-2211. Perhaps you have some thoughts about the immigration crisis. Perhaps you have some thoughts about whether or not the federal gas tax should be raised to upgrade the country's highway infrastructure. And do you think Congress should pass a law that would allow states to impose their sales tax on items that you purchase online? 1-800-639-2211. Congressman, there are a lot of issues that we want to talk about today, but let's just start off with the situation in Ukraine and the shooting down yesterday of the commercial airliner with roughly 300 people on board. President Obama says there needs to be a full accounting of who's responsible for this tragedy and that the guilty party should be brought to justice. But there are some folks in Congress who think the president has taken too soft a stand on this issue. For instance, Senator John McCain says if there's any evidence that Russia is in any way connected to this situation, quote, there's going to be hell to pay. And McCain also sharply criticized the president for not doing more to support the military and the government of Ukraine in their fight with Russian separatists. That's the larger picture, according to Senator McCain. Is he right?
No, I don't. He's not right. I mean, Senator McCain has a very aggressive military-based approach. I mean, he was a strong advocate of going into Iraq. He was a strong advocate of nation building in Afghanistan. He's a strong advocate of even going back into Iraq now. And I'm not quite sure what he's proposing the president should have done about the Ukraine that he didn't try to do. So that feels to me that it is consistent with the approach that Senator McCain has taken. You know, he's a war hero. He was a pilot. But his first inclination is to provide a military solution for what is essentially any kind of political problem around the globe. Now, having said that, there's a part of what Senator McCain says that I'm in agreement with. I think the core problem here is Putin. Putin's a problem. I mean, he sees Crimea. That has long historical connections to Russia. And frankly, the West wasn't able to do much about that. But then he went yet another bridge too far when he started encouraging the pro-Russian separatists in southeast Ukraine. And that's unleashed. That's unleashed this disaster because all of the evidence right now indicates whether the Russian involvement. This was a missile, by all indications, that could have only come from Russia. And whether it was the separatist with or without direct involvement of the Russian military, the separatists did not get this missile at a garage sale. So Putin is a problem. And what I would hope is that Senator McCain would take a constructive approach with others who agree that Putin is a problem, where the focus is on coordinated sanctions with Western Europe to really react to the Putin overreach here.
Well, there are going to be a number of members of Congress who are going to say, hey, we've had sanctions for a while. The president announced more sanctions just this week. Are sanctions enough?
If you're suggesting that we're going to have boots on the ground in the Ukraine, that is, I think, a very unwise place to go. Sanctions can have a slow and steady impact. The fact is that Western Europe has to be involved. And there's two things here right now in the immediate moment. Number one, President Poroshenko in the Ukraine is, I think, handling this very well. He's calling for a complete and thorough investigation before he does the saber rattling. And it's his airspace that was violated. And the second issue here is Putin and what's his response going to be. Because, again, once it's proven, as it appears it will be, that it was a Russian missile, then that really is Russian responsibility. That's Putin responsibility. And he is the one, more than anyone else, who's unleashing the pro-Russian separatist military action in the Ukraine. And if we're going to resolve this, it's not as though President Obama or the American military can be asked to solve that problem with whatever Senator McCain may suggest is the next military option. You need Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany. You need Western Europe. And you need a coordinated and aggressive approach that puts some punishment on Russia. They're starting to feel the effects in their economy, even without the sanctions, because of the reckless conduct of Mr. Putin. But I do think that there ultimately has to be a political resolution, but I think sanctions are the best option, not military action by the United States of America.
So if it turns out that Russia is involved in some way, would you support greater U.S. military assistance, not soldiers being sent there, but greater military assistance to the government of Ukraine?
Well, I possibly would. The question is whether that'll be effective. What's the most effective thing to do? Ultimately, you need a political resolution. And whether military assistance is going to, quote, be helpful. Obviously, this is something where Putin has the ability to deny the separatist access to these weapons. You know, the indications are right now, the evidence was that the separatists did have access to an aircraft, and they shot down some Ukrainian military planes. And this may have been a mistake, a, quote, mistake on their part. But it's not a that doesn't reduce the culpability of the outrageous thing that they did and the provocative and facilitating conduct of President Putin. So he's got to back off.
Let's switch gears and look at the immigration crisis right now. Over the past few weeks, more than 60,000 undocumented children have streamed across the border into the United States. They're still coming at a record pace. What should be done in the short term to deal with this situation?
Well, let's put this in context, because in the short term, you know, we have these kids that are 6, 7, 8, 10 years old, 12, 13, 14. I mean, they're children who have made this journey from Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador. Those mainly are the countries they've come from to escape the threat of violence in those countries. And they're not what they're doing is showing up at the border and turning themselves into the border patrol, hoping that they can get some safety. So on a humanitarian level, any of us understands that for a parent to allow a child to make that incredibly dangerous journey, and many of these kids don't make it, then that is because they have to escape the incredible violence in their communities. And there's been some documented stories about these 12-year-old boys who were recruited to be in gangs. They try to get out of the gang, and they get shot. There was a 7-year-old boy who went to find his 12-year-old brother, and he got stoned and beaten to death. So you can just imagine the heartache of parents fearing that when their kid goes off to school, they won't come back. So when they show up here right now, what we're trying to do is feed them and clothe them and take care of them. But what has happened is that this enormous explosion in unaccompanied children showing up has strained the capacity of the government to address it. You know, the HHS, the Health and Human Services Program, was funded for about 8,000 kids that might be in this situation. And, of course, there were 52,000 kids in the last couple of months. So we're just not there yet. And I think we have to do two things. One, we do have to take care of the kids that are here. And then, two, we have to have some long-term approach that has as its focus providing some safe conditions and safe processing in their own countries. You know, there's a lot of faith-based organizations like Catholic Charities that are providing substantial aid to kids in Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala. And the long run has to be to try to provide safe conditions so that these kids are not being sent on this perilous journey to the United States. That would be unsustainable in the long run.
Let's turn to our listeners and talk to Linda, who's calling from Enosburg. Hi, Linda. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Thanks, Peter. You do such a great job. Thanks for voting against the pothole in the pensions. I wish that we could, I'm a clergy person. I wish that we could show compassion to refugees coming to our country. I wish we could welcome some to Vermont. I think it would be a good idea to dip into some education funds and establish a school or fund some of our underpopulated schools in Vermont to establish Spanish immersion programs. It could benefit Vermont children as well as the refugees.
Peter, what do you think of that idea?
Well, you know, the governor's indicated that Vermont will do its share, and Vermonters always do their share. And, of course, we've had a long-term refugee resettlement program that has been quite successful, and Vermonters have been very generous. So I get your point, and I think the governor's making it clear, Senator Leahy made it clear that we'll do our share. But there's one thing that really is on my mind. You know, if you're a parent in Honduras or El Salvador or Guatemala, the best thing really is for your child to be able to live with you in safety. So I think that we've got to have a focus here on the long term of trying to take practical steps that are going to allow families to be together. So, yes, we're going to do our part. But I also think that we've got to have that focus on the long term, because this is not a sustainable situation that's good for families in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, that they can't have their kids safely be with them every day.
Let's turn to Tim in Hyde Park. Hi, Tim. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And Congressman, thanks so much for your efforts on behalf of Vermont. I love having your voice out there. Regarding the immigrant children, the thing that really, really bothers me and disappoints me is the national tone, or at least the tone that seems to be publicized in places like Facebook and the more outrageous websites regarding border, civilian border patrols and people who are ordering their armed militias to shoot children on sight at the border. And the horrible things that people are proposing to do to these kids who, you rightly said, have been traumatized both at home and then on their journey. And I guess what I'm wondering is, do you have a sense of the national tone both across the country and within Congress about really what ought to be done with these kids and how it should be done?
Well,
I'll take my question off the air.
You know, let's put this in the context of the overall issue and the necessity, in my view, for immigration reform. The Senate, Senator Leahy's committee, the Judiciary Committee, with his leadership, passed a comprehensive immigration reform bill. And that is, in my view, extremely important for our country. It would be good for Vermont. We have a lot of farm workers who are immigrants. We have a lot of folks who work in the tourism industry. And the country, we have a lot of dreamers, the people who were born here, to people who did not have legal status, but they've been an American. They've been American all of their lives. And it would be good for the country, it would be good for those people if we could have comprehensive immigration reform, in which, by the way, we could address some of these asylum issues. And there's a tone in the House, I think, unlike in the Senate, where there's a real hostility to immigration reform. And some of it is reflected in the type of, I think, unacceptable rhetoric and accusations that you mentioned. So this is a tug of war. And I think that this issue here about these unaccompanied children has its own distinct dynamic from the immigration reform issues up to this point, because these children are being they're coming here out of total desperation for their own personal safety, and that's putting a lot of additional pressure on the whole immigration reform debate.
Congressman, we got this email from Eric who wants to know how many kids have died or been murdered on their way here. By closing the border, we will be saving lives. If their home country is so terrible, why isn't the UN looking into it? You have members of Congress who want to deploy the National Guard to secure the border. And some people listening might say, you know, there are already 60,000 undocumented children here. If you resettle them in different states, there are going to be more children coming behind them. And so in the short term, how do you deal with that?
Well, see, I think that point is a valid point. There are kids here. By the way, this is not a border enforcement issue. These kids are coming here to be picked up by the Border Patrol. It's not like they're trying to sneak in. They're showing up and saying, here I am. But what the, I think, point of that email or caller makes that I think has really important validity is this isn't sustainable. So how is it that we can work with the governments down there to try to provide some safety in their own countries? By the way, a lot of the unaccompanied minors, they're not just coming to the U.S. They're going to some of the neighboring countries that don't have the that aren't plagued with violence in Central America. I mean, you've had a lot showing up in Nicaragua, in Panama. So that's the thing that concerns me, is that we've got a short-term issue where we've got these kids here, and we want to make sure they're taken care of. They're here, and under international asylum law as well as the U.S. law, when they're fleeing persecution and violence, they have a different status. But is it sustainable to just have this be ongoing and open-ended? And the answer to that is no. So how do you then address it? Well, that's the longer-term approach where you're trying to work with the governments in those countries and the faith-based groups that do provide safety and shelter to kids in peril. So I think a lot of the focus should be on trying to work there at the source rather than here after the fact.
Today on the program, our guest is Congressman Peter Welch. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. We've been talking about immigration issues. We're going to turn our sights to a number of issues involving the internet and also the possibility of raising the federal gasoline tax. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Congressman Peter Welch, and our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. If you've got a question or a comment for the congressman, a great opportunity to talk to him, 1-800-639-2211. Congressman, there's been a renewed effort in Congress to pass a bill that would allow individual states, if they wanted to apply their sales tax to items that are purchased on the internet. And actually, it's being attached to a bill that prohibits the taxing of services and access for consumers to the internet. Now, in the past, you've supported the internet sales tax plan. I think it was the Main Street Fairness Act or something like that. Is it still a good idea?
Yeah, it definitely is. Let's make a distinction between the two things. The legislation that I support about not taxing the internet is you not getting taxed when you're hooking up on the internet. The sales tax, the Main Street Fairness Act, which I am a sponsor of, a lead sponsor with a Republican from Arkansas, Steve Womack, is not a new tax. It's just requiring that when the retailer is an internet retailer like Amazon, if you buy a book on Amazon, that retailer has to collect the sales tax in the same way that if you went down to your local bookstore, that local brick-and-mortar retailer would have to collect the sales tax from you. And in fact, under current law in every state that has a sales tax, I mean, every state is free to decide we want a sales tax or we don't. But under current law, if you purchase in Vermont on the internet, you're technically required to pay the sales tax even if it's not collected. So that's called the use tax. As a practical matter, the only way the sales tax really works is if the retailer is the one that does the collecting at the point of sale. So this is about a level playing field. You know, our brick-and-mortar retailers, they're incredibly important to our downtown communities, our village centers. And anybody in retail, they face stiff challenges. And they're willing to meet them. And they're willing to compete with the internet. But they want to do it on a level playing field. So if they have to collect the sales tax, why shouldn't the internet, Amazon, have to collect the sales tax?
So what do you think the likelihood is that this bill might pass in the coming weeks? It seems like in the last week or two, there's been renewed interest in it in Washington.
Well, see, this is one of those situations where if that bill went on the floor, you know, it passed the Senate, and we've got the votes to pass it on the floor in the House. But the way the House works is that the majority is able to decide yes or no on putting a bill on the floor for a vote, and they're keeping it off. But we put that vote on. If we put that on the floor, we'd have a substantial number of Republicans and a substantial number of Democrats that would vote to pass it. So we've got a shot. You know, the Senate has already passed it, and everybody. There's a strong bipartisan support for making certain you and I don't pay taxes on getting hooked up to the internet. So we want to pass that bill. And in the Senate, the plan is to try to attach the Main Street Fairness to that bill. It has broad bipartisan support. So I'm hopeful that we've got another shot at doing this. This would be good for Vermont.
You know, there's some businesses in Vermont who sell goods on the internet, and they think this sales tax plan will hurt their business in the future.
Well, here's the point that they make, because I've met with them a lot, and you're right. We've got a lot of businesses where they have a brick-and-mortar operation, but they also have an internet operation. Most of the folks, when I talk to them about it, the concern they have, and this is absolutely legitimate, is it's got to be simple. So what they don't want to have to do is have to go through the nightmare of 50 different sales tax jurisdictions. So the real challenge for us to treat those folks right is to make certain that the software and the collection process is simple. So that's the point where I think they have a lot of legitimacy, but I think we can address it.
Speaking of the internet, the FCC is considering a plan that would allow some internet service providers to charge companies more money if they want faster access on the internet. Now, the FCC has been flooded with letters on this subject. In fact, they extended their public hearing process. Most are opposed to the plan. What's wrong with the FCC plan? What's wrong with allowing the marketplace to offer different types of access services?
Well, there is some different types of access now. Just when you get your plan as to whether you want to buy 10 megabits or 20 or four or more. But there's two issues that concern me and why I am a strong supporter of net neutrality. Number one, you want the overall access to that internet to be available to a startup in a garage, just like it is to Google. Google, by the way, started in a garage, but you want that opportunity for good folks, entrepreneurs who have a good idea to have access to the internet that is absolutely essential to them having any shot. And then second, the concern I have is, will this result in a unfair price gouging against consumers? That's a concern I have. So I'm against the fast lane, slow lane deal.
A lot of listeners would like to talk to you today. Let's start off with Marvin in Brandon. Hi, Marvin. Welcome to the program.
Hi. My question for Peter is, if we can give money, loan money, to Citigroup, JPMorgan Chase, all the rest of the big companies at near zero interest rates, why are we charging students 7% plus on their student loans?
Well, it's pretty outrageous, and you stated it very well. I'm in agreement with you, and that's why I'm supportive of Senator Elizabeth Warren's legislation that basically says, hey, if the overnight lending rate to banks or the Treasury bill is like 2+%, why can't we have that amount be what we charge our kids? Why don't we give that rate to our kids and our parents? And I support that. This crisis in the affordability for college education is really at the breaking point. You know, I've been trying to do my best on focusing on how do we get aid up for kids and also get costs down for kids. And the idea that the federal government is charging 7%, 8%, 9% when its borrowing costs are about 2.5%, so that we're making money off of kids and parents who are paying for college, that's really wrong. And you point out the contradiction. Why are we giving the big banks a free ride but hammering parents and students who are trying to get ahead?
Congressman, the president is talking about putting together a plan to try to discourage colleges and universities from raising their tuition. Many places now, you could see the tuition be anywhere from $15,000 to $20,000 or as high as $60,000. Is there really a role for government to tell these private institutions what they can charge for tuition?
Well, there should be a public-private partnership here, because one of the frustrations I have is a person who, trying to be in the tradition of Senator Stafford and Senator Jeffords, who did so, so much to help our students get access to education, is standing by and observing that if we raise money that is available for grants and loans to kids, every dollar we give them suddenly gets eaten up in a dollar increase in tuition. So, you know, a lot of these colleges depend on the taxpayer, frankly, to provide these grants and loans to kids. Well, it seems to me that it's fair for the taxpayers to ask our university administrators to keep a lid on the cost. So we've got to go at this educational spending issue on the revenue side to help our kids, but also on the cost side to keep those tuition increases down. By the way, on that, I'm working with Trey Gowdy. You know, he's a very conservative guy from South Carolina. And he just got appointed by Speaker Boehner to be the head of the Benghazi committee. But he and I are working on an educational reform bill where we would do two things. One, provide some we'd have a commission review all of the regulations that that the colleges and universities are subject to try to see where we can streamline and reduce some of the burdens and costs on our colleges. And then secondly, to give our colleges some flexibility so that they can try to accelerate graduation. So instead of kids going, you know, it's the usual four, but a lot of kids go five, try to see if it can be 3.5 or 3 years with various flexibility offerings. So, you know, we're trying to get a bipartisan approach here to dealing with the cost side as well as the grant and loan side.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Lydia, who is calling from Shelburne. Hi, Lydia. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I want to switch over to transportation, if I could.
Sure.
In the news this morning, I heard that fuel-efficient vehicles may contribute to the lack of money in the Transportation Trust Fund, and I wondered if Peter could comment on that.
Well, you're right. You know, if you have electric vehicles and you're using less gas, and actually we have a lot of cars that use gas that are getting higher mileage, then the revenue from the gas tax declines. And obviously, folks who are driving an electric vehicle are using the roads the same as somebody driving a diesel or a regular gas. But our funding formula and mechanisms are not keeping up with the technology. So I'm actually in support of finding a way so that all of the various types of vehicles that are on the road, using the road and then benefiting by maintaining and building our roads and making our bridges safe, that everybody has to contribute to that effort.
Would that be some sort of proposal that would tax people based on the miles that they drive?
Well, that's one of the most popular proposals, and I don't know whether that's workable yet or not, and there's a lot of privacy concerns about that. But it does get to the heart of the point the caller made. You know, if I'm driving down the road in my gas vehicle and you're driving next to me in the electric vehicle, we're using the same road, getting the same benefit. And, you know, my view, we should each be contributing for the benefit that we're enjoying.
Now, the federal gas tax has not been raised, I think, since 1993. Right now, it accounts for about 75% of the money that's needed in the Federal Highway Trust Fund. We asked on our Facebook page what people thought about the idea of raising the federal gas tax. You said you would be supportive of a long-term solution, and you suggested that a 10-cent increase might be a good idea. Here's what we got on our Facebook page. Jessica wrote, "I'd actually be okay with it as long as it could be capped at 1 or 2 cents per gallon. Seems like it would add up pretty quickly, and a small price to save some of the wear and tear on my car would be a good idea." Estella wrote, "Well, this tax is going to be passed along to consumers and have a ripple effect through our stagnant economy. It will hurt rural Vermonters who drive for a living, commute to work, and buy goods and services." Peter actually wrote us on that same question about eliminating tax credits for natural gas and electric vehicles because they use the highway and they need to pay. Bill wrote us, "The gas tax hasn't been raised since 1993 and roads and bridges need to be maintained. Raise the gas tax sooner the better." And Brian wrote, "How about putting a $2 toll booth at our Massachusetts, New York, and New Hampshire roads? You already tax Vermonters to the breaking point. He does not support an increase in the gas tax." So very briefly, you said 10 cents a gallon. Why is that a good idea?
Well, first of all, raising revenues on transportation, the gas tax or registration fees, any of the various fees that we have to pay, tolls when you're traveling, that's tough. You know, because you got to get from here to there. You've got to commute to work. We live in a rural state, and a lot of people drive a lot of miles. But here's the bottom line. Potholes don't fix themselves. And Congress is – it's bizarre. The way we think we can talk about an infrastructure that is going to pay for itself. We've got bridges and we have roads, and that's in, it's true in Vermont. It's true in Texas. It doesn't discern whether it's a Republican or Democratic district that need to be maintained. And if you're going to maintain your infrastructure – those are long-term obligations. You have to have a sustainable way of paying for it. So no tax is – nobody wants to pay more. But I think Vermonters understand you don't get a free ride. And what Congress is doing, much to my dismay, is failing to meet its responsibility to have a sustainable funding source so that all of our states can follow a regular schedule of maintenance and repair of roads and bridges. And what we just did where we voted for, quote, a temporary fix, this was the second temporary fix in the last couple of years. When we did it a few years ago, it was intended to buy us time so we could get a long-term solution on the revenue side. Well, we squandered the time, and we don't need more time. We need a decision. So I voted against this bill. So, by the way, it's only going to last until May of next year, and we'll be right back at it. And, you know, you cannot have long-term planning when you've got an eight-month horizon on funding on capital projects that can take years. So it's really irresponsible. And the funding source in this is it just astonishes me. What we're doing is allowing companies that have pension plans to contribute less into their pensions. And then that'll mean there'll be more tax revenue from the corporations. So in effect, what we're doing is we're going to fix a pothole in the highway system by creating a pothole in the pension system. So my view, this is congressional irresponsibility at its worst.
Let's talk to Bob in Johnson. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Peter. Bob Hoag. We're old friends.
Yep. Hi, Bob.
Son when he was in Iraq. Nice hearing you talk. I think it's a great idea. I think the 10 cents isn't bad. I just don't know. The garbage man can send out a bill to when he gets a bigger fuel bill. The school buses can. But I run an ambulance service, and I can't send out a bigger bill. And you guys haven't given me a raise in years.
Well, thanks for doing your really good work. But I, call my office. I'm not sure which program it is that is shorting you for the good work that you provide with your ambulance service. But obviously, you've got real expenses that are going up. I mean, you're one of the folks when the cost of gasoline goes up, when transportation costs, you got to repair your ambulance. we've got to pay a fair amount. So call my office and let me look into what the specifics are.
Today on the program, our guest is Congressman Peter Welch. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. If you'd like to ask a question, make a comment, 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest is Congressman Peter Welch. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. Before we leave the issue of transportation, let's get a quick call in from Bob in Burlington. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind?
Hi. How are you doing, guys? Peter, just as the cost of health care goes up both at the rate of inflation and innovation, the cost of road usage goes up by use and abuse. So I would urge you to look at something that, I mean, the guy that's driving down the road in the electric car, very small, fuel efficient, blah, blah, blah. The cost of driving and the weight that the roads bear from the interstate truck traffic has increased weight-wise, gone down cost-wise significantly. So once again, we're, as the usual, an average citizen subsidizing that end of business. So there's got to be a little give, because with the new move to throw a toll on all the interstates and everything else, it seems like the continuing trend to whack the little guy is moving forward. And I'd like to see that addressed sometimes in legislation. Thanks.
Well, yeah, good point. And as you know, in the state, Vermont does have different – it's the diesel tax and there's truck fees, and there is a recognition that weight is a factor in the wear and tear on the highways. So whether we'd be able to calibrate that at a federal level, I think, is tough given the composition of the House of Representatives. But I know it's a point that is valid, and I know that Senator Mazza and Representative Brennan take that into account when they're doing their work here on our behalf in Montpelier.
Let's turn to Mary Alice, who is calling from Putney. Hi, Mary Alice. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I would like to talk about the drug war. I feel as though the drug war that we seem to be trying to, you know, waging in this country is the reason those kids are coming up here. I mean, their lives, what's making their lives so dangerous in the countries they're coming from is the presence of drug cartels and drug gangs. And and I feel as though the uses of anything that's in capitalism, anything that's illegal, is costs more and attracts people more. And I feel as though there probably are people who would like to use drugs recreationally, and that could be handled. And I think that the sooner we end the drug war, the sooner we'll clear a lot of black men out of our prisons. The drug rate is actually, whites use drugs at a higher rate than blacks do, but here in this country, they're often stopped for some routine thing, like a headlight that's off or something, and then it turns into, the Supreme Court has allowed them to turn it into a drug search.
So, Mary Alice, are you suggesting that most of these drugs just be legalized?
I think I am. Yeah, I think that people are willing to people who want to use them. You know, we'll learn how to handle them. We ought to have rehabilitation instead of jailing people.
All right. Congressman Welch, what do you think of that idea?
Well, I'm not for legalization of all drugs. But I also think that the point is that there's been a lot of mistakes made in the, quote, war on drugs. There's been a lot of disparate prosecution and treatment. I mean, one of the real vivid examples is crack cocaine versus powder cocaine in the sentence disparity, depending on which you're caught with. So I do think there's been a lot of mistakes made in the war on drugs. But I think drugs are a real problem, and how best to deal with them obviously is very tough. And we're you know, facing some real challenges in Vermont now. But I'd be pretty tough on some folks who were bringing drugs up, like meth, from other places and really trying to get our kids hooked on it. So I'm quite open to trying to take practical steps to have drug enforcement work better and be more sensible and change our laws where they need to be changed. But I'm certainly not in favor of legalizing all drugs.
Well, let's look at marijuana. We have two states that have legalized marijuana, the state of Washington and Colorado. Vermont is studying that issue, and most likely next winter, lawmakers will be voting on a legalization bill. In addition, more than 15 states, including Vermont, have passed medical marijuana laws. Now, all these efforts are in violation of current federal drug laws, and the DEA is shutting down some of the medical marijuana dispensaries in California. Do you support the bill that removes, essentially, federal authorization to take action against states where marijuana laws have been legally put into place?
I do. The federal government should accept the decision of the states. Medical marijuana, I mean, this – I've never understood why there's such a uproar about medical marijuana. You know, this is about a doctor and a patient, and it's about their judgment as to whether or not a particular prescription – can alleviate suffering, alleviate pain. And we, of course, are totally okay with doctors making a decision to prescribe things way more powerful than marijuana, you know, real opiates. So why would the federal government want to get in the way of a decision by a state legislature in Montpelier or Spokane or Denver and get in that way? It really is getting in the way of the doctor-patient relationship. So no, the federal government should accept the decisions that our states make on medical marijuana.
Well, how about extending it to the legalization of marijuana? We've got Colorado. We've got Washington. The Shumlin administration is doing a detailed study in the next 4 or 5 months to see the effects of legalization in Vermont. Would you extend that same concept to the legalization?
You know, I don't know if I would yet, because I'd actually want to talk to law enforcement folks, because you can legalize in a state and then – it can have implications on an adjoining state when you're talking about legalization. I think it doesn't have the same controls that prescription medication has. And what you're doing with medical marijuana is essentially allowing a doctor to do what a doctor does, prescribe a particular substance for a medical reason. And there are tighter controls in that. So I actually don't know yet, but I'd really want to get some input from law enforcement and public health people.
Congressman, recently Senator Patrick Leahy announced that he'd support former Senator and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton if she decides to run for president in 2016. He says she is the most qualified Democrat by far to run. How about you? Are you endorsing Hillary Clinton at this time?
I'm not endorsing anybody who hasn't decided and told us that they want to run. I mean, we all know what Senator Leahy says about Senator Clinton, and he has a long relationship with her. They work together, and he worked with her husband. So he's got a special long-term relationship that, frankly, I don't have. I mean, I've met Secretary Clinton, but it's not like I know her the way that Patrick does. And, of course, in Vermont, we know that Bernie Sanders is thinking that he may run for president. And obviously, he's got a voice that speaks to the heart of the challenges that middle class and working families face. So let's wait and see who's going to run.
You know, there's some people who would like to see Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren run. She was up in Vermont not too long ago. You might have been at that event. It was a big Democratic fundraising event. A lot of people think that she would be a great candidate. What do you think?
I think she's great. You know, I worked with her a lot before she was in the Senate. We were doing Dodd-Frank. And she, before she got in public politics, as you know, she was a real advocate for she was one of the people who was really talking about how bad things were in Wall Street. And when my experience with her was that she was very practical, very informed, very gracious. She's tough as nails. but wanted to make progress, not just make a speech. And I thought she was terrific. And I was there when she was in Vermont, and she gave a tremendous speech. So no, I think she's wonderful.
Well, this has been a great discussion of a lot of important issues today. Congressman Peter Welch, many thanks for being on Vermont Edition today.
Thank you.
That is our program for today. Now, Monday on Vermont Edition, we're talking wine. Many people would love to know more about wines, but find it all a bit intimidating. We'll talk with a restaurant wine manager and a retailer who love to share their knowledge with the uninitiated and the wine connoisseur alike. Send us your questions or comments about wine appreciation, or share a favorite vintage by emailing vermontedition@vpr.net and listen Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Sangari, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Catherine Hayes. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.